From claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt.
EWTN Radio presents The Miracle Hunter with Michael O'Neill.
Welcome to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Hey everyone, hope everyone's enjoying the summer-like weather. At least that's how it feels here around Chicago. Big change from not too long ago, and it's pretty nice going back from Poland and Lithuania to this beautiful weather here in Chicago. And when I think of beautiful weather, I always think about the times ahead. And when we think about the times ahead in the church, we think about the need for saints. And that's saints with a lowercase s, that's each and every one of us who are called to be holy, who are called to be followers of Christ. And then there are people who maybe are going to be the capital S saints, those people who might be saints, as I like to say. And we talk about people on the path to sainthood all the time on this show. We talk about advancing from servant of God to venerable to blessed and then to saint. Well, we've got future saints that we'll be talking about on today's show who are at the servant of God stage and maybe shortly coming soon, at least in my opinion, we'll see both of these named venerable in not too long. We've got Father Emil Capon, and we'll be talking to Roy Wenzel, the author of the book, The Miracle of Father Capon, Priest, Soldier, and Korean War Hero. Also, we'll be talking later in the show to Aaron von Uffel, the vice postulator for the Sister Marie de Mandat Grance canonization cause. She's a servant of God from France, then Turkey, but her cause is run through the United States, a historic cause, and her story perhaps is the best of all future saints, in my opinion, her role in the discovery of the House of Mary in Ephesus. So I'm so excited to talk again to Aaron von Uffel in just a little bit. And check out my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from 10 books and available at EWTNRC.com. And because of that book, I've been getting some attention from the Washington Post and also from the Hartford Courant, who've been contacting me because there's a chapter in that book related to Eucharistic miracles. And there's all the buzz, of course, about the potential Eucharistic miracle there in Hartford, Connecticut. So keep your eye out for some articles coming soon from the Washington Post, where they interview me about Eucharistic miracles. But check that one out, Science and the Miraculous. You can get that one at EWTNRC.com. Later in today's show, we're going to be looking at the 365 Days with Mary project like we always do. We talk about that for every single day of the calendar year, there's a different Marian devotion, a feast day or a commemoration of a miracle or some other major event that lines up exactly to the day's date. For today, May 27th, we've got the Virgin of Sorrows from La Corocera in Spain in the year 1945. And the might-be saint of the day for today's feast day of May 27th, we've got Blessed Gausberto of Monsalvi, who lived in France and died in the year 1079. And the question of the week, with the new solemnity for Our Lady of Good Help, does that mean the apparitions are recognized by the Vatican? It's a complicated answer. I'll try to answer that one in just a little bit. Let's take a look at the miracle news. We do this every week where we look at the miracles happening around the world and those things that relate to miracles. And I always post these on my social media, whether it's Facebook or Instagram. I've got a big following there, 20,000 followers. So people get to hear about these incredible miracle stories when they follow me on social media. Oftentimes on this show, we have some big miracle stories and a lot of smaller miracle stories, and the smaller ones are great. But I really get excited about these good ones. And we have a big miracle story this week, reported by Catholic News Agency. We have the headline, A Miracle in Missouri, Body of Benedictine Sisters Foundress Thought to Be Incorrupt. And for those people who don't know, strangely enough, in the history of the Catholic Church, there are several hundred saints. They are incorrupt, either partially or whole incorrupt, in the sense that their body has not undergone the normal ravages of time. And there's a case here in the United States, which is fascinating. So hundreds of pilgrims have descended on a Benedictine monastery of religious sisters in rural Missouri in recent days after news began to spread on social media last week that the recently exhumed remains of the Contemplative Order's African-American foundress appear to be incorrupt 4 years after her death and burial in a simple wooden coffin. Now, with incorruption, this can last hundreds and hundreds of years, but in the case of this one that they just discovered, she's 4 years in. So her name is Sister Wilhelmina Lancaster, OSB. She founded the Benedictine Sisters of Mary, Queen of the Apostles. They're best known for their chart-topping Gregorian chant in classic Catholic hymn albums.
In 1995, at the age of 70, she left the Oblate Sisters of Provence, her community of over 50 years, to do so. And she was known for the traditional Latin Mass, attending that, and her faithfulness to the Benedictine contemplation and liturgy of the hours. She died in 2019 at the age of 95 on the vigil of the Solemnity of the Ascension. 4 years later, on the Solemnity of the Ascension in the Latin Rite, the Abbess and sisters decided to move her body to a final resting place inside their monastery chapel, a long-standing custom for founders and foundresses. And they, of course, expected to find just bones, but the Benedictine sisters instead unearthed a coffin with an apparently intact body, even though the body was not embalmed and the wood coffin had a big crack down the middle of it. So moisture and dirt for any amount of time was able to get in there, and that doesn't help with incorruption, I'm sure. And there's a quote from the current abbess of the community, Mother Cecilia. She said, quote, "We think she's the first African-American woman to be found incorrupt." And the body was covered in a layer of mold and had grown due to the high levels of condensation within the cracked coffin. And despite the dampness, little of her body and nothing of her habits disintegrated for 4 years. The shock was instant for the community, who gathered to exhume her. And the abbess said, "I thought I saw a completely full, intact foot." And I said, "I didn't just see that." So I looked more and more carefully. And so this is quite an interesting article on Catholic News Agency, but there's clearly shock at this phenomenon, and many pilgrims are going there to Missouri, to that chapel, to see this incorrupt body of the foundress of these Benedictine sisters. So pretty amazing miracle news this week. You can connect to the Facebook feed of The Miracle Hunter, or you can connect with me on Instagram, join any of my 20,000 followers, and you can connect and see the pictures, which are pretty remarkable, of this the body of this Benedictine sisters foundress. And we'll find out more. And the big question that everybody asks is she a saint or on the path to sainthood in any way? No, she's not. She's not even a servant of God. However, I'm pretty sure when they find an incorrupt body, that sort of thing gets kicked into high gear. They probably will start the canonization process and see if they can move forward with that as soon as possible, because of the interest and the sign that this is, perhaps, of a holy woman. So check that one out. Check out my Facebook page to find out more about the Benedictine Sisters Foundress and this miracle in Missouri. Let's take a look at Catholic Club Trivia. We do this every week, where we ask a trivia question and give out a prize to an emailer who writes in with the correct answer. And last week, for the month of May, the month of Mary, we asked the question, what is the technical name of the veneration given to Mary, as opposed to that to other saints or the worship given to God? The worship given to God in the Greek is latria, and the veneration given to the saints is dulia, and the veneration or the extra veneration given to Mary is hyperdulia. So thanks to everybody who wrote in with that correct answer. And we're talking today about future saints in this in our Catholic Church in America. And so the question is, who was the most recently beatified person in the United States? So again, we're talking about servants of God, sainthood causes here in America. And so the question is, who was the most recently beatified person here in the United States? If you think you know that answer, want to win the prize, the image of the faces of Mary, send me an email to miraclehunter@ewtn.com, or just go to my website, miraclehunter.com, and click on the contact tab, and you can send me a message that way. And answers and winners will be posted on the show page on miraclehunter.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to Roy Wenzel, author of The Miracle of Emil Joseph Capon. We'll be talking about that incredible Korean War hero and future saint. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to The Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Miracle Hunter Radio Show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. People who tune into this show or tune into my EWTN series, they might be saints on Fridays on EWTN, know that I love talking about future saints
especially future American saints. And in my opinion, perhaps maybe it was COVID cutting things short, as it did for a lot of people in a lot of ways, I believe that Father Emil Joseph Capon is perhaps the next venerable that we'll see coming from the United States. He's a soldier and Korean War hero and served in World War II and the Korean War, and his story is absolutely amazing. And perhaps even more incredibly, it seems like they have a couple of miracles already to go that has been investigated by medical experts and are truly amazing stories of the intercession of this incredible priest. And so we're so grateful today to be joined by Roy Wenzel, the author of The Miracle of Father Capon, Priest, Soldier, and Korean War Hero, and also the producer of the Emmy Award-winning documentary Once Was Lost about his life as well. Welcome back to the program today, Roy Wenzel.
I'm glad to be here.
It's great to have you back, and I think that people really need to know the story of Father Emil Capon. This is something that a lot of people can get excited about, feel inspired by, and many Americans don't even know this story, that we have this future saint on the cusp. I really do believe that he will be the next venerable in our church if things move forward like I expect that they will. So he's a great person to get to know. So for those people who don't know, please tell us, who was Father Emil Joseph Capon?
Well, he lived only to the age of 35, and the first 34 years of that are, by journalistic standards, pretty boring. He was a Kansas farm kid in central Kansas, fairly at the edge of poverty farming with his family, and from an early age made it known that he wanted to be a priest, even before he became a boy in the local tiny little church in the tiny little community of Pilsen. And he did become a priest, and in this tiny little town, hardly ever got out in the world. But the guy ended up being incredibly, extraordinarily heroic. Joined the army as a chaplain in World War II. Didn't see any combat then, and then went back to his little town after the war, after serving in India and Burma, a couple of places, and then. Just before the Korean War broke out and before anybody knew it was going to break out, he rejoined the army because he liked the whole adventure thing and was in Japan with the 8th Cavalry Army Regiment in 1950 when the Korean War broke out. And that infantry regiment was one of the first to be sent from Japan and from U.S. forces in Japan to try to stem the tide of the North Korean invasion. And he survived another 6 to 7, 8 months under horrific combat conditions. Early on, the army was always outnumbered, and the North Koreans were using everything from tanks to mass suicide charges into the American machine guns to try, and they knocked the Americans all the way back down to a tiny little toehold at the bottom of South Korea. And then rallied and advanced rapidly all the way to the North Korean border with China. And there were battles along the way, and he was absolutely amazing. He was like an Indiana Jones character in not only his heroics in dragging wounded soldiers off the battlefield, but in hyping them up and making them feel good about themselves under horrible conditions of combat and stress and hunger. He was constantly doing for people. People joked that he never slept. He would take dictation from wounded soldiers and write letters to their mothers and fathers back home. He would run off into the distance and come back to the line of march with apples in his pocket or something to hand out. And then his unit was essentially wiped out just south of the Chinese border. He was heroic there, too. So those who didn't die were forced marched to a prison camp. So he did all of these heroics in the battlefield, and then there were just incredible heroics from about November until he died the following May in 1951, where he stole food from the guards, defied their brainwashers. They were trying to get the soldiers to turn on their own country and, you know, make recordings denouncing the U.S. He stood up to the guards. They were starving in this camp. So he would give away his own food to try to get the soldiers from stealing from each other, and they just adored him. He also snuck out constantly, crossed the wire, snuck out, came back, you know, with his pockets full of food. The officers were separated from the enlisted men, and you could get in real big trouble if you went over to the enlisted men. He was an officer, and he did this all the time and had prayer services in the hut. And in those prayer services, they weren't just prayer services. He rallied all these guys to stay alive because they were starving. They had on summer clothes, and it was like 40 below by December. And he rallied them with prayer and with little talks and acts of kindness. And then when they saw him stand up to the guards and the brainwashing, man, they would just do anything for this guy. Eventually, he starved himself. They were all starving. They died by the hundreds in this camp. Eventually, he succumbed to starvation and diseases that were in the camp. It was pretty horrible. And they came out of the survivors of this camp came out of the war telling everybody what an incredible guy this was. It wasn't just that he was incredibly brave. He was also incredibly clever. He kept hundreds of people alive that would have died. He literally saved hundreds of lives by doing, he would take roofing tin, pieces of broken roofing tin from bombings, and he would take a stone, because he had no tools, and then he would pound on this piece of roofing tin until he made a pot that didn't leak. And then, because they didn't give them water either, he would scrape snow into this thing and melt it down and boil it, and that prevented dysentery. And so he taught other people how to do that. So I talked to about a dozen of his POW friends, and I kind of rolled my eyes at first when they said that he saved hundreds of lives, because that sounds like an old fish tale. But I think it's true. I think he did that, not only saving a whole lot of people on battlefields, but then the whole cooking pot and dysentery thing probably saved hundreds.
Absolutely amazing. We're talking today with Roy Wenzel, the author of The Miracle of Father Capon, about the priest, soldier, and Korean War hero that is on the path to sainthood. And from what you can tell in the interviews and your research, did people view him as a saint or a saintly figure after they came back from war?
Ironically, a lot of the soldiers that lobbied for sainthood, that lobbied the priests and investigators to make this guy a saint, are Protestants and Jews, mostly Protestants. I mean, the Catholics in the camp did that too. So, yeah, they all tried very hard to talk to everybody after they came home for decades. They kept this little flame burning. One of them, Mike Dow, who's still with us, was down in the Houston area, tried immediately after returning to the United States to get the Medal of Honor, to get him recommended for the Medal of Honor, wrote the whole thing with help from generals, and they turned it down at that time. So the church launched an investigation soon after the war to see whether he was worthy of sainthood, and they all chimed in. They gave testimonials, they gave audio recordings, they wrote stories, they wrote letters. And eventually in 2013, President Obama awarded the family, gave the family the Medal of Honor for him. Sainthood investigation is still going on, and it's been going on since essentially 1953.
And when we look at the sainthood process today, of course, listeners to this show know the path from servant of God to venerable to blessed to saint. And he's a servant of God at this point. Is there any movement on his canonization cause that we can look forward to?
Well, the main guy that has been appointed essentially by the Vatican to run point on this is a guy that I just talked with yesterday, Father John Hotze from Father Capon's old diocese of the Wichita Diocese in Wichita, Kansas. And he, about 10 years ago, sent what amounted to two bedloads of documents, recordings and physical, records of what he did. So the investigation has been incredibly detailed, thorough. So the dozen POWs that I talked with, plus, maybe another 20, 30-odd that other people interviewed, that's all in Rome. All the newspaper stories, the television documentaries, everything that's ever been done about him is now in the possession of the Vatican. But they are all... They run, the Vatican investigators run on their own timetable.
That's right.
So Father John has joked with me that, it took him 500 years to give to give the title to Joan of Arc. So, you know, it's been since 1953 with our guy. So, you know, we'll see.
There you go. It's always a long, long process. The church moves sometimes at a glacier's pace. We're talking today with Roy Wenzel, the author of The Miracle of Father Capon. And there was some interesting news that came out not too long ago about the discovery of his body. Tell us what that news was and your involvement in all of that.
Well, he died in the camp, as I said, a combination of starvation and disease and murder. The POWs that knew him say that the Chinese guards essentially murdered him by shooting him or hitting him in the head, but they saw that he was declining in health, and so they sped that along. And toward the last, they actually isolated him and denied food and water to him. He was already so frail he couldn't stand up and could barely speak. So they essentially just, hate to say it, but they just kind of had a couple of also starving POWs dump his body in a shallow hole behind this little shed where he died, covered him up, and that was it. And so there were hundreds of other POWs who died, and their bodies were treated similarly, usually in mass graves. He ended up in a single grave. And everybody came home in 1953, 2 years later, everybody. The survivors came home, and the North Koreans, as probably everybody knows, they don't have a lot of use for us in America, and so they're very difficult. They did return bodies right at the end of the war, and that is key. They returned a few hundred bodies remains, including from the prison camp, and because he was a famous war hero by then, at least in the military and among some church people, there's been this desire to find him. And the POWs all told him it's impossible. Everybody ended up in a mass grave along a riverbank, so the river's probably flooded a few times. So, the POWs thought it was impossible. But as it turns out, he was sent home. And as part of a, agreement between, it was actually the Chinese, because they had entered the war in 1950, late 1950, and they were a little more cooperative at the end of the war than North Koreans, so they shipped a bunch of skeletal remains home to us. A lot of them, I think 800-odd or so, ended up as buried as unknowns, as they called them, in the Punch Bowl Cemetery on the island of Oahu in Hawaii. That's where Honolulu is. And then when DNA came along and became a thing in the late 90s, there was this renewed, could we identify some of these 800? Well, there were terrible technological problems in doing that. But eventually, they at great expense, they figured it out. And so for the last 10 years or so, they've been digging up guys buried in the Punch Bowl, not only from the Korean War, but, for example, from the bones and skeletal remains that were buried as unknowns from the USS Oklahoma, which was sunk in Pearl Harbor very quickly. And so a lot of guys ended up dead inside the ship, and they couldn't identify them when they got them out years later. So the military takes this very seriously. They spend millions of dollars every year, not only searching for remains in Vietnam or the Pacific Islands and South Korea, but they make a hell of a good effort to try to identify people who are unknowns buried in cemeteries in Europe and in Hawaii and elsewhere. And so, and just amazingly to everybody involved with the Father Capon story, they found him. In 2021, they identified his remains as one of the unknowns. And, of course, this was a big deal, not only because he was a Medal of Honor soldier, but also a candidate for sainthood. And so I'd been covering this story since 2009. We wrote the book, The Miracle of Father Capon, in 2013. And went to the White House, so I was there for the Medal of Honor ceremony. And so 2 years ago, I was retired, but when I heard that they found his body, I called up my old outfit, the Wichita Eagle newspaper, and volunteered to come out of retirement, and because I knew the story and had boxes and file cabinets full of stuff on him. And so Travis Hine, my project story partner and I teamed up again. We spent 6 months piecing together the story about how they found him, which is just absolutely amazing. So, I mean, it's an amazing story, even if you don't care about Father, or even if you're not Catholic, the story of how our military relentlessly went after this, trying to find him, spurred on by these old, really, really elderly men now. There's only two or three of them left alive. But for over the course of 70-odd years, they kept that torch burning, and they were the reason he got the Medal of Honor, besides his own heroism. They just kept hammering on this and knocking on doors and writing to people and insisting, if possible, we really want him found and brought home. And so they did. They brought him home, and two of those POWs, Mike Dow and Paul Roach, were allowed just the day before they interred him in the cathedral here. They went to the funeral home. I was there for that too, Travis and I. And they were allowed, they opened the casket. His skeleton was incredibly, remarkably intact. And they not only got to say goodbye to him, but, you know, with the family's permission, with the Capon family's permission, you know, they touched him. They got to put their hands on their old friend. And that's probably the most moving, incredible thing I've ever seen in my life.
Absolutely amazing. Oh, thank you so much, Roy Wenzel, author of The Miracle of Father Capon, for joining us on today's program, telling us the incredible story. And your film, Once Was Lost, actually won an Emmy Award, as you told me off air. And so that's an incredible accomplishment for you. So thank you so much for your work, bringing this future saint to light for us. And hopefully in due time, we'll see Father Emil Capon named a blessed, a venerable blessed, and then a saint. And for people who want to find out more about you, Roy, and your work, what's the best place where they can go?
Just Google my name. It's all out there, Roy Wenzel. And Once Was Lost is the documentary, as you said, and The Miracle of Father Capon.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Roy Wenzel, for joining us on today's program.
Thank you.
God bless. That was Roy Wenzel, author of The Miracle of Father Capon, and also the Emmy Award-winning producer of Once Was Lost. So check that one out. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be looking at the question of the week. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to The Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to The Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm The Miracle Hunter. Hey, I love getting your questions. People write in from around the world with questions about miracles happening in today's world and those that have happened centuries ago. And people write in, but I also like when I give talks, I travel around the country, maybe give 20 or so talks per year where I talk at a conference or a parish or otherwise, another Catholic group, and I give a presentation and I talk for about 45 minutes. And at the end, I always do a question and answer section. And that's always my favorite because it's fun to see what people are thinking about in the world of miracles. And I do my best to try to answer those questions. And for better or worse, I know a lot of the answers, and I'll try to get the answers to people as they come up with these. So we had a good question being emailed in this past week. It says, Dear Miracle Hunter, as you have no doubt heard, the Shrine of Our Lady of Champion recently received permission from the Holy See's Dicastery for Divine Worship and Discipline of the Sacraments to celebrate the feast as a solemnity. Could this be considered, quote-unquote, Vatican recognition? Thanks. TB. Well, thanks, TB, for your question. And as people know on my website, I have sort of a way of looking at Marian apparitions where we talk about those things that have been approved by the bishop or recognized by the Vatican. So the local bishop is the one who does the investigation, sets up that commission, perhaps gets all the data coming back, makes a judgment, was this a true vision or not? If it was a true vision, they'll do a formal statement like Bishop David L. Ricken from the Diocese of Green Bay did on December 8th, 2010. And he said that those apparitions received by Adele Bryce, the 28-year-old Belgian farm worker in 1859. Those visions were worthy of belief by the Christian faithful. And so it comes out with that Latin phrase, constate supernaturalitate, established as supernatural. Now, what's very interesting in the history of Marian apparitions or the procedure for Marian apparitions is that goes around to the local bishop. The next local bishop normally just goes along with what the first bishop says. But theoretically, a later bishop could find out more information, could reinvestigate, and could overturn
overturn an approval or overturn a condemnation, depending on how his predecessor ruled. And so what the Vatican will do is the Vatican stays silent in many cases, doesn't say anything. The local bishop is the first and foremost authority, as laid out in those 1978 rule book, the norms of the Congregation for Proceeding and Judging Alleged Private Revelations and Apparitions. In that document, it says the local bishop is the main authority. And so the Vatican doesn't have to do anything for an apparition to be considered fully approved canonically. But the Vatican will, on some occasions, show some sign of support. They might canonize the visionary. They might set up a basilica or a feast day or release their own document, or the Pope might compose a prayer, or he might visit the site. These are all various ways that the Church shows some sign of recognition from the Vatican. And so in this case, we have the Shrine of Our Lady of Champion having received a solemnity, not for the world, not for the Church at large, not for the Diocese of Green Bay, but for the shrine itself. It's a very limited thing. A solemnity, of course, is a wonderful thing, and they approve the name change of Our Lady of Good Help going from to Our Lady of Champion. And so in my research into this and talking to those who run the shrine there, I did have that same question. Was this recognition by the Vatican, giving it a solemnity, the equivalent of the Vatican solidifying or giving its full approval to the supernatural character of the events? And it has come out that, no, it is not fully approved from Rome. It is fully approved by the local bishop. That's all we need. But Rome has not put its sort of sign of approval or cementing it for all time as an approved apparition. But with a solemnity in place, I think that's a pretty safe bet that someday the Vatican will show further signs of recognition, and no future bishop could ever overturn it with a solemnity in place. So it's caught in a little bit of a middle area, in my opinion. But thank you for your question, TB. And of course, we consider Our Lady of Good Help, Our Lady of Champion, to be an approved apparition, the one and only case in the history of the United States. Let's take a look at 365 Days with Mary. This is a project we do every week where we look at the Marian devotion of the day as it lines up exactly to the day's date. We all know Fatima May 13th, or Lourdes February 11th, or Guadalupe December 12th, but there are different smaller ones all around the world, miraculous occasions, apparitions, weeping statues, and other miracles that have happened on each and every day of the calendar year, whether it's a feast day, commemoration of the miracle, the building of a church, or otherwise. Each and every day, there's a different title of Mary. And you can go to my Facebook page of 365 Days with Mary and join any of the 10,000 other followers who get the daily update on the Marian devotion of the day, or download the app 365 Days with Mary, available for free at the iOS App Store. So for today's date, May 27th, we have the Virgin of Sorrows from La Codosera in Spain in the year 1945. And the story goes at 3 p.m. on May 27th, 1945, a girl, Marcelina Esposito Barroso, and her cousin, Agustina Gonzalez, were walking to the next village to run an errand. And they had gone about 2 miles when Marcelina saw something on the road. Our Lady of Sorrows was halfway up the trunk of a tree, with a black cloak embroidered with stars, hands together, and a beautiful but sorrowful face. The vision disappeared, and the girls ran to the village and told their mother what had happened, and the word spread. On June 4th, the Blessed Virgin told her to walk on her knees, which she did without a scratch, and the diocesan curia of Badajoz has not yet officially pronounced on these facts, but has allowed the construction of a shrine there. So this is one of these cases where they allow faith expression, which is the stage prior to approving an apparition as authentic. And that is the Virgin of Sorrows from La Codosera in Spain in the year 1945. For more information on this fascinating devotion or any of the hundreds of other Marian devotions from around the world, you can go to 365dayswithmary.com. You can pick up the book. You can go to the Facebook page of 365 Days with Mary, or download the free app, 365 Days with Mary. Let's take a look at They Might Be Saints. We do this every week where we talk about those people on the path to sainthood, and this lines up with my television show, which airs on Fridays on EWTN, talking about Americans on the path to sainthood. And we always like to keep you up to date on the latest and greatest sainthood news, see who's coming down the pike. And in a recent audience with the head of the Dicastery for the Causes of Saints, Pope Francis approved the movement of several new future saints, moving them along the path to sainthood from servant of God to venerable and beyond. And so one of the big news items, one of the inclusions of those approvals from Pope Francis was a surfing saint. Pope Francis recognized the heroic virtue of Guido Schaeffer. The Catholic Church is one step closer to canonizing a surfing saint. Pope Francis recognized the heroic virtue of Brazil's surfer angel, Guido Schaefer, in a decree issued by the Congregation for the Cause of Saints on Saturday. Schaefer was a seminarian, a doctor, and a surfer who drowned while surfing in 2009 off the coast of Rio de Janeiro at the age of 34 before he could fulfill his desire of being ordained to the priesthood. He's a Brazilian seminarian known locally as El Anjo Surfista, or Surfer Angel, and he used to begin each of his surfing lessons with a prayer and was known for his work for the poor, providing medical care to Rio's favelas, the poor working class neighborhoods, alongside the missionaries of charity. And with this decree, Pope Francis declared Schaefer venerable, and the church will need to approve a miracle attributed to his intercession before he can be beatified, and a second miracle will lead to his canonization. So that's a movement on the sainthood cause of Guido Schaefer from Brazil, the surfing saint, as he's a surfer angel, as he's known locally there in Brazil. For more information on They Might Be Saints and who's coming down the pike, go to theymightbesaints.com. Let's take a look at the Might Be Saint of the Day. We talk about those people on the path to sainthood, those venerable servants of God, blessed, perhaps before they have all their miracles approved by Rome, and they become a saint. And people can find out more at theymightbesaints.com or tune into my television series, which airs on EWTN on Fridays, They Might Be Saints. For today's date, May 27th, we have Blessed Gausberto of Monsalvi from France. And he was a priest, a hermit, an Augustinian monk, and then an abbot at Monsalvi Abbey in Clermont-Ferrand in France. And he helped turn the house there into a hospice to assist pilgrims to the various holy sites. And he was considered to be a great spiritual teacher and was renowned for being the teacher of Blessed Bernard of Rodez. I always like that when one saint or blessed teaches another saint. There's all kinds of cases like that in Catholic history. And he died in 1079 of natural causes. He has one miracle attributed to his intercession. And with a second miracle, or the equivalent canonization of Pope Francis, he will move on to sainthood. And that's Blessed Gausberto of Monsalvi from France. For more information on this fascinating saint or any of the other saints from around the world who might be saints, go to theymightbesaints.com. We need to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to be talking to Aaron von Uffel, the vice postulator for the Servant of God, Sister Marie de Mondragrande, the woman who found the House of Mary in Turkey. Stay with us for that.
Now, back to the Miracle Hunter on EWTN. Here's Michael O'Neill.
Welcome back. You're listening to the Miracle Hunter radio show on EWTN Radio. This is Michael O'Neill. I'm the Miracle Hunter. On this show, we talked earlier today about Father Emil Capon, the future saint from Kansas. And we've got another future saint to talk about today. And in my opinion, perhaps she has the most fascinating of all the future saint stories of causes run here in the United States. And that is of her life in France, then her life in Turkey, and her founding of the Holy House of Mary in Ephesus. It's a truly incredible, almost an Indiana Jones style story. And we are so blessed to be able to feature her story on a very early episode of They Might Be Saints. And so people can find out more if they go to EWTNRC.com. You can find out, you can see the episode or purchase the DVD for the episode related to Sister Marie de Mondragrande. And I'm so excited today to talk to the promoter of that canonization cause of Sister Marie, and that is Aaron von Uffel. Welcome to the program today, Aaron.
Thank you so much, Michael. I'm thrilled to be able to talk about Sister Marie to your audience, and since you're a miracle hunter, we're hunting a miracle for Sister Marie.
That's right. It's always great to talk with you, and it's great to have you back on the show. And yes, we are hunting for miracles for Sister Marie, because as of right now, she's a servant of God. She'll move to venerable, and then she'll need those two miracles to move on to blessed and to saint. And the story of Sister Marie de Mondragrande is truly remarkable. I can't help but say that of all the sainthood causes I've looked into, hers is perhaps the most amazing, the life that she lived. From where she started to where she ended up, and some of the great contributions she had, especially related to the House of Mary. Let's just dial it back a little bit. Please tell us about the early life of Sister Marie de Mondragrande.
Sure. Sister Marie truly lived a fairy tale life. She was born in a castle. Her mom and dad were the count and countess of Grancey. They had the town named after them. Everyone in the village came to their property to go to mass at the collegial church that was named and sanctioned and officiated both by the popes themselves. She comes from a rich history of generational graces that flowed through the families. Her saint that started the Memorari. We've got different saints, that Pierre the Venerable, who was the first person to translate the Quran. She's got two popes in the family. Both of them had to do with different reasons why the Franciscans today oversee the Holy Land. They've been in charge of all of the holy sites, and it's interesting because from that beginning, God had placed his seed inside of Sister Marie to plant this beautiful blossoming lily to become a daughter of charity, who then went from her beautiful castle where she was being served to serve others. She worked as a nurse, as a pharmacist, as a teacher, and in the House of Mary with orphans, several places in France during wartime. So she really experienced very difficult times where she had to provide for not only her sisters, but for all of the children. When there really were no provisions, she was able to get the people around her to rally, to help one another, and to also help her own people. After all of the children were settled and everything had been taken care of in her orphanages, God gave her a new mission, and that was to go and find the house that the Blessed Virgin Mary lived in with St. John the Apostle. And
tell us how she knew where to go for that. Where would that information be about the House of Mary?
So at the time that God was stirring this in her heart, a new book had hit the press, and it was written by Clemens Brentano, who was the scribe for Anne Catherine Emmerich. And St. Anne Catherine Emmerich had visions of the Blessed Mother's life. She was given incredible gifts of being able to see the past, present, and the future. And she described who would have been coming and going from the house. So we know that all of the apostles visited the home. We know that St. John built the home for her after Jesus died, and on the cross, Jesus said, "Behold your mother, mother, behold your son." And from that moment on, St. John took the Blessed Virgin to live with him. And when things got very difficult in Jerusalem and they started to kill everyone, especially from the moment that St. John's own brother was murdered, they decided to get out of Jerusalem and to take care of the Blessed Mother. And they brought her to Ephesus, which was a much more religiously tolerant city in that time. And they didn't live right in the city. They lived in the outskirts, up in the mountain. It was a mountain called Nightingale Hill. And they made a stone house that is still there to this day. And Anne Catherine Emmerich gave almost like a treasure map, your Indiana Jones effect here, of if you followed what Anne Catherine Emmerich wrote, there's no way you wouldn't make it to the house, which is still standing today, which is quite remarkable, because if you've ever been to the Holy Land, you know that you have to go down many, many, many layers of foundations before you get to something original. However, just like the Blessed Mother has been preserved, the home that she lived in Ephesus was also preserved. There were pine trees that were behind it, and before it, there it was the sea. And they were from her home, she could actually see the island of Patmos, where St. John received the Book of Revelation. So if St. John wasn't with her physically in the house, she could see where he was. It's just a remarkable story.
Absolutely. That story is truly amazing, of Sister Marie de Montecronce. And what I found when we did the research on this and we put together that program, one of the things I found was so fascinating is, sure enough, she discovered this home through the writings of Anne Catherine Emmerich, and she was able to locate that house. And then through her connections, her family's wealth, she was actually able to purchase that House of Mary and preserve it, which is an absolutely amazing thing. I assume in that region, it's mostly Muslim territory, so having a Christian enclave there is truly amazing.
Right. And the Daughters of Charity they're one of the only order that you are allowed to use your own wealth from your family or your inheritance for the glory of God. And so God had already arranged for her to be in a family that would have so much money. If anybody's been to Paris and stayed in the Ritz Hotel, that was one of the many residences of the Grandsay family. So she went to her father and she said, okay, if I were to have been betrothed to one of the royal houses throughout Europe, like her sister had been, you would have given me such and such amount of money. I would like to use that money to preserve this home for all time. And you can just imagine if one of your children came to you and said, there's a dirt plot, we see some stones, and there's women who are working tobacco fields who lay their leaves on this home. We think it's the Blessed Mother home. We'd like you to buy it. You know, most people would say, you're out of your mind. And if anyone else in Europe finds out about this, we will be laughed at off of every list of parties and, you know, social gatherings, because that's what a lot of the people were really into at that time. Although her family was very holy, they still didn't want to have that kind of notoriety if it went south. But Sister Marie is not the type of person that you can say no to. And when she knew that this was something that God truly was telling her to do, she was able to pray and persevere, and yes, she was given the money. And then she had to find a way also to get transferred over to Turkey, because it's not like you could just raise your hand and say, well, now I'd like to go to this part of the world. You're a servant of God. You have different people in charge. And just at that time, Pope Leo XIII was calling for missionaries, and he needed them to go to that part of the world because the Ottoman Empire was redoing all of their roads and restructuring their engineering on so many different things, and the French businessmen had just gotten a contract. So he needed to have French-speaking missionaries in that part of the world. You know, it's amazing. When God wants you to do something, he just makes everything, all the doors open, so that That's right. All you need to do is just walk through them and just do God's holy plan. And she got there, and then the next step was, who is she going to find to go up into these mountains? Because she's a nun in a habit. She was able to talk to of the priests into it after a long story, which you really do need to read the book because it's such a fascinating story, even with these priests, and you're going to just love it. You got to get that from Tan Books. And they wound up finding the house, and then they brought in people who were atheists to try to prove it's not the house. You know, they wanted to have, like, the devil's advocate take charge and say, you know, it's definitely not it.
So what did the archaeologists say at that investigation?
Well, you know, one of them said, I'm so upset because now I do need to believe in there's a higher being because this truly is from it. They were able to take stones that they already had from that time period, and they said, yes, this is exactly the same stone. Then when they were doing some digging, they found skeletons. And the most interesting part is that their head, their hands, and their feet were not pointing to Jerusalem. They were pointing to the house. Mm. And that automatically told them that there was something much more important in that home that they needed to pay attention to. And in their hands, they had the coins from that period of time. So all roads were leading to, yes, this definitely was the place. And what's really interesting is when they did more digging, they came across the fireplace stones that had to be removed from the center of the house, because that's the way it was when the Blessed Mother lived there. They were going to turn it into a chapel. These are the apostles turning it into a chapel. They literally were making almost the first church out of Mary's house. And so they buried these fireplace stones in the back area closer to where they kept the tabernacle. And when they were looking for the round part of where the tabernacle would have been, that's when they found the stone. Hmm. And they gave one of the stones back to Sister Marie. And it's still in the family castle.
Incredible. Incredible. What an incredible story, the finding of the House of Mary in Ephesus through the work of Sister Marie de Mondot Grance. What an amazing backstory for somebody who's being considered for sainthood. We're talking today with Aaron von Uffel, the promoter of the canonization cause of Sister Marie de Mondot Grance. And this is a historic cause. Of course, this is from so many years ago, and yet the cause is still being carried on today. What can we look at as far as the status of this cause? I know that she's a servant of God. How will she move on to the next step of Venerable?
Well, we're actually waiting for the postulator over in Rome, Dr. Andrea Ambrosi's office, to write the biography. And they have all the information, so we're hoping that they will do that, because then she will be declared the next step. And in the meantime, we are imploring people to pray to Sister Marie. The best part about you listening, anyone out there, you have the possibility of hitting it really big with some huge favor. Most people who pray to Sister Marie do not really know who she is. We've gotten testimonies from people who say, I'm not even Catholic, but I heard she bought the House of Mary. I'm Jewish. I sell houses. And when I pray to her, I sell all my houses. people who have gotten the prayer card, they notice that the prayer card almost acts like a relic. And if it's placed on somebody's body, if it's God's will, they're getting miraculously healed. I can tell you from my own family, my mom, and you know, a prophet's never taken seriously in their own household. So not that I'm a prophet, but my mom would hear Sister Marie, Sister Marie, Sister Marie, and in one ear, out the other. But when my dad had his toes turn black, all of a sudden she's on the phone saying, what do I do? And what's this about Sister Marie? And I said, well, I'm getting so many testimonies of people placing it on, contacting it with the place of their body and just saying, God, through with your glory, please allow Sister Marie to heal this part of my body if it's something that is okay with you. And whether they say the prayer or not, it's happening. You know, they just say, Sister Marie, please intercede in the name of Jesus. And if they say the prayer, that's even better. But the very next day, my mom called and she said his toes were perfect. Absolutely perfect. And you know, something that turns black, it doesn't reverse ever, 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 ever. One of my nephews had retinoblastoma. And he had contact with the prayer card. They placed it on his eye. His mom implored Sister Marie. And Sister Marie started to instruct her on what to do and what not to do for this child. And the doctor to this day calls him the miracle baby. And there's many, many things that have happened with this. You know.
That's wonderful. There are so many cases of graces, intercessions, blessings, favors that we might say through the intercession of Sister Marie de Mondot Grance, who is a servant of God, and hopefully in due time we'll move ahead to Venerable, Blessed, and then Saint. Well, we're so grateful to you, Aaron von Uffel, the promoter of the canonization cause of Sister Marie de Mondot Grance. And if people want to find out more about this incredible future saint, where can they go?
They can go to SisterMarie.com.
Wonderful. Well, we're so grateful to you, Aaron von Uffel, promoter of the canonization cause of Sister Marie de Mondot Grance, for talking to us about this great future saint. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, and we're hunting for those miracles, so get back in touch with Michael and let him know.
Thank you, Aaron. God bless. And that was Aaron von Uffel, and that's all the time we have for today's show. If you missed any of this episode or want to catch up on past episodes, you can go to EWTN.com/radio, check out the audio archives, or download the free EWTN app. I'd like to thank our guest today, Roy Wenzel, author of The Miracle of Father Capon, and Aaron von Uffel, the promoter of the canonization cause of Sister Marie de Mondot Grance. Check out my EWTN television series, They Might Be Saints, on Fridays, and explore with the Miracle Hunter on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. And look for my latest book, Science and the Miraculous, How the Catholic Church Investigates the Supernatural. It's out from Tan Books and available at EWTNRC.com. I'd like to thank you for joining me today on Miracle Hunter, where from claims of healings and visions to the world's most inexplicable events, whether you're a believer or a skeptic, the truth is always worth the hunt. Talk to you next week.